Part 2. Chapter 1. The Hospital. Shortly after the Christmas holidays, I fell sick and was sent to the military hospital, which was situated about half a verst from the fortress. It was a one-story building, very long and painted yellow. Every summer a great quantity of ochre was expended in brightening it up. In the great courtyard there were buildings, including the doctors' residences. The main block contained only wards. There were a good many of them, but as only two were reserved for convicts, these were nearly always full, especially in summer, and it was often necessary to crowd the beds. The two convict wards were occupied by unfortunates of various classes. There were the civilians, then the military prisoners who had previously been incarcerated in the guardhouses. There were others again who were awaiting trial, or who were merely passing through the place. In this hospital, too, were invalids from the disciplinary company, a melancholy institution for bringing together soldiers of bad conduct with a view to their correction. At the end of a year or two, they come back the most thoroughgoing rascals on earth. When a convict felt sick, he told a non-commissioned officer, who wrote the man's name down on a card, which he then gave to him and sent him to the hospital under escort. On arrival, the patient was examined by a doctor who authorized the convict, if he were really ill, to remain in hospital. My name was duly written down, and towards 1 o'clock, when my companions had started for their afternoon work, I went to the hospital. Every prisoner took with him such money and bread as he could, for food was not to be expected the first day. A little pipe and a pouch of tobacco with flint, steel, and matchpaper. He concealed these articles in his boots. On entering the hospital, I was curious to learn something about this new aspect of life. The day was hot, cloudy, sad. One of those days when places like a hospital assume a particularly disagreeable and repulsive look. Together with the soldier escorting me, I entered the reception hall, where there were two copper baths. Two other convicts and their escorts waited there. An assistant surgeon came in, looked at us with a careless and patronizing air, and went away still more indifferently to inform the physician on duty of our arrival. It was not long before the doctor arrived. He was most affable, examined me, and gave me a paper on which my name was inscribed. The physician in ordinary of the convict wards was to diagnose my trouble and prescribe treatment and diet. I had already heard the convicts say that the doctors could not be too highly praised. "They're fathers to us," they used to say. The three of us next changed our clothes. Our uniforms and linen were taken away, and we were supplied with hospital linen, to which were added long stockings, slippers, cotton nightcaps, and a dressing gown made of very thick brown cloth, which was lined, not with linen, but with filth. The dressing gown was certainly foul, but I soon discovered its utility. We were afterwards taken to the convict wards, which were at the end of a long corridor. They were very high and spotlessly clean. The external cleanliness was quite satisfactory. Everything visibly shone. So at least it seemed to me after the dirtiness of the convict prison. The two prisoners whom I had found in the entrance hall turned to the left of the corridor while I entered another room. A sentry with musket on shoulder marched up and down before the padlocked door. Not far off was his relief. The sergeant of the hospital guard ordered him to let me pass, and suddenly I found myself in the middle of a long, narrow room with 22 beds arranged against the walls. Three or four of them were as yet unoccupied. These wooden beds were painted green, and, as is notoriously the case with all hospital beds in Russia, were doubtless inhabited by bugs. I was allotted one in a corner near the windows. There were very few prisoners dangerously ill and confined to bed. The patients were mostly convalescent, or men who were slightly indisposed. My new companions lay on their couches or walked up and down between the rows of beds. There was just space enough for them to do so. The atmosphere of the ward was stifling, and had the odour peculiar to hospitals. It was composed of various emanations, each more disagreeable than the other, and of the smell of drugs. My bed was covered with a counterpane, but as the stove was kept well heated all day long, I removed it. The bed itself consisted of a cloth blanket lined with linen, and coarse sheets of more than doubtful cleanliness. By the side of the bed was a little table with a pitcher and pewter mug, together with a diminutive napkin. The table could also hold a samovar if the patient were rich enough to drink tea. These men of means, however, were not very numerous. The pipes and tobacco pouches, for all the patients, even the consumptives, smoked, could be hidden under the mattress. The doctors and other officials scarcely ever made a search, and when they caught a man with a pipe in his mouth, they pretended not to have seen. The patients, however, were very cautious, and always smoked at the back of the stove. They never smoked in bed, except at night, when the officers in charge made no rounds. I had never before been a patient in any hospital, and everything was quite new to me. I noticed that my entry had a strange effect on some of the prisoners. They had heard of me, and all the inmates now looked upon me with that slight shade of superiority which recognized members of no matter what society show towards a newcomer. On my right lay a man who had been committed for trial on a charge of coining. An ex-secretary and the illegitimate son of a retired captain, he had been in the hospital for almost a year. There was nothing whatever wrong with him, but he had assured the doctors that he had an aneurysm, and he so thoroughly deceived them that he escaped both the hard labour and the corporal punishment to which he had been sentenced. 12 months later, he was transferred to an asylum at TK. He was a vigorous young fellow of 28, cunning, a self-confessed rogue, and something of a lawyer. He was intelligent, had easy manners, but was very presumptuous, and suffered from morbid self-esteem. Convinced that there was no one on earth more honest and just than himself, he considered himself innocent and made no secret of his opinion. This personage was the first to address me, and he questioned me with much curiosity. He initiated me into the ways of the hospital, and of course began by telling me that he was the son of a captain. He was very anxious that I should take him for a noble, or at least for someone well connected. Soon afterwards, an invalid from the disciplinary company came and told me that he knew a great many noblemen in exile, and, to convince me, he rolled off their Christian names and their patronymics. It was only necessary to watch the face of this soldier to understand that he was an abominable liar. His name was Chekunov, and he took an interest in me simply because he suspected me of having money. When he saw that I possessed a packet of tea and some sugar, he at once offered me his services to procure me a samovar and boil the water. M.D.S. Khad promised to send me my own by one of the prisoners who worked in the hospital, but Chekunov arranged to get me one forthwith. He obtained one made of tin, boiled my water, and, in a word, showed such extraordinary zeal that he drew down upon himself the scorn of a consumptive patient whose bed was just opposite mine. This man was named Ustyantsev. He was the soldier who, when condemned to the rods, stricken with terror, swallowed a bottle of vodka in which he had infused tobacco, and thus brought on lung disease. I have already spoken of him. He had remained silent until now, stretched out on his bed and breathing with difficulty. His serious look was always turned in my direction, and he never lifted his gaze from Chekunov, whose civility irritated him. His extraordinary gravity rendered his indignation comic. At last he could stand it no longer.
"Look at that fellow! He's found his master," he said, stammering out the words in a voice strangled by weakness, for he had now not long to live.
Chekunov, much annoyed, turned round.
"Who is the fellow?" he asked, looking at Ustyantsev with contempt. "Why, you're a flunky," replied Ustyantsev,
as confidently as if he had the right to call Chikunath to order.
"I, a flunky?" "Yes, you're a flunky, a true flunky. Listen, my good friends, he won't believe me. He's quite astonished, the brave fellow."
"Well, what of it? It's obvious when a man doesn't know how to make use of his hands that he's not used to being without servants. Why shouldn't I give him a hand, you buffoon with a hairy snout?"
"Who has a hairy snout?"
"You."
"I have a hairy snout?"
"Yes, you certainly have."
"You're a nice fellow, you are. If I have a hairy snout, you have a face like a crow's egg."
"Hairy snout! The merciful Lord has settled your account. You'd do much better to keep quiet and die."
"Why? I'd rather prostrate myself before a boot than a slipper. My father never kowtowed himself, and never made me do so."
He would have continued, but an attack of coughing convulsed him for some minutes. He spat blood, and a cold sweat broke out on his low forehead. If his cough had not prevented him from speaking, he would have continued to declaim. One could see that from his look, but he was powerless to do more than move his hand, with the result that Chikunov spoke no more about the matter. I quite understood that the consumptive patient hated me far more bitterly than Chikunov. No one would have thought of being angry with him or of despising him for the services he rendered me and the few kopecks that he tried to earn from me. It was generally recognized that he did it all in order to obtain a little money. The Russian people are not at all susceptible in such matters, and know perfectly well how to take them. I had displeased Ustyantsev, just as my tea had displeased him. What irritated him was that, in spite of all, I was a gentleman, even with my chains, that I could not do without a servant, though I neither asked for nor desired one. In fact, I tried to do everything for myself, so as not to appear a white-handed, effeminate person, and not to play a part which excited so much envy. I even felt a little pride on this point. But, in spite of everything, I don't know why, I was always surrounded by officious, complacent folk who attached themselves to me of their own free will, and who ended by ruling me. It was I, rather, who was their servant, so that, whether I liked it or not, I was made to appear a nobleman who could not do without the services of others, and who gave himself airs. This exasperated me. Ustyantsev was consumptive, and therefore irascible. The other patients showed me nothing more than indifference, tinged with a shade of contempt. They were preoccupied with a circumstance which I can still recall. I learned, as I listened to their conversation, that there was to be brought into hospital that evening a convict who, at that moment, was being flogged. They were looking forward with keen curiosity to this new arrival, but they said that his punishment was not severe, only 500 strokes. I looked round the ward. The majority of genuine patients were, as far as I could see, suffering from scurvy and disease of the eyes, both peculiar to this country. The remainder suffered from fever, tuberculosis, and other illnesses. There was no segregation of the various diseases. All the patients were together in the same room. I have spoken of genuine patients, for certain convicts had come in merely to get a little rest. The doctors admitted them simply from compassion, particularly if there were any vacant beds. Life in the guardhouse and in the prison was so hard compared with that of the hospital that many preferred to remain lying down in spite of the stifling atmosphere and the rules against leaving the room. There were even men who took pleasure in this kind of life. They nearly all belonged to the disciplinary company, examined my new companions with curiosity, and one of them puzzled me very much. He was consumptive and was dying. His bed was a little way beyond Ustyantsev's and almost next to mine. His name was Mikhailov. I had seen him in the prison 2 weeks before, when he was already seriously ill. He ought to have been under treatment long before, but he bore up against his malady with surprising courage. He did not go to the hospital until just before the Christmas holidays, and died 3 weeks later of galloping consumption. He seemed to have burned out like a candle. What astonished me most was the terrible change in his countenance. I had noticed him on the very first day of my imprisonment. Next to him lay a soldier of the disciplinary company, an old man with an evil expression, and whose general appearance was disgusting. But I am not going to describe every patient. I refer to this old man simply because he made an impression on me, and at once initiated me into certain peculiarities of the ward. He had a severe cold in the head, which caused him to sneeze every few moments. This he did even in his sleep, as if firing a salute of 5 or 6 guns, while each time he called out, "My God, what torture!" Seated on his bed, he crammed his nose eagerly with snuff from a paper bag, in order to sneeze more strongly and with greater regularity. He sneezed into a checked cotton pocket handkerchief, which was his own property, and which had lost its colour through perpetual washing. His little nose then became puckered in a most peculiar manner with a multitude of wrinkles, and his open mouth revealed broken teeth, decayed and black, and red gums moist with saliva. When he sneezed into his handkerchief, he unfolded it and wiped it on the lining of his dressing gown. His proceeding disgusted me so much that I involuntarily examined the dressing gown which I had just put on. It exhaled a most offensive odour, which contact with my body helped to bring out. It smelt of plasters and medicaments of all kinds, and seemed as though it had been worn by patients from time immemorial. The lining had, perhaps, been washed once, but I would not swear to it. Certainly, at the time I put it on, it was saturated with lotions and stained by contact with poultices and plasters of every imaginable kind. Prisoners condemned to the rods, having undergone their punishment, were brought straight to the hospital with their backs still bleeding. As compresses and poultices were placed on their wounds, the dressing gowns they wore over their wet shirts received and retained the droppings. During the period of my imprisonment, I was in hospital on several occasions, and it was always with mistrust and abhorrence that I put on the dressing gown provided for me. As soon as Chekunov had given me my tea, I may say in parenthesis that the water brought in the morning and not renewed throughout the day was soon corrupted, soon poisoned by the fetid air. The door opened, and the soldier who had received the rods was brought in under double escort. I saw for the first time a man who had just been whipped. The event was by no means infrequent, but whenever it happened, it caused great distress to the other patients. These unfortunate men were received with grave composure, but the nature of their reception usually depended on the enormity of their crime, and consequently on the number of strokes administered. The criminals most cruelly whipped, and who were celebrated as first-rate villains, enjoyed more respect and attention than a simple deserter, a mere recruit, like the one who had just been brought in. But in neither case was any particular sympathy manifested, nor were any annoying remarks made. The unhappy man was attended to in silence, above all if he was incapable of attending to himself. The assistant surgeon knew that they were entrusting their patient to skilful and experienced hands. The usual treatment consisted in frequent application to the poor fellow's back of a shirt or piece of linen steeped in cold water. It was also necessary to extract from his wounds the splinters of the rods which had been broken on his back. This last operation was particularly painful to the victims, and the extraordinary stoicism with which they supported their sufferings astonished me greatly. I have seen many convicts who had been frequently and cruelly whipped, but I do not remember one of them uttering a groan. After such an experience, however, the countenance is pale and distorted. Their eyes glitter, the look wanders, and the lips tremble, so that a patient sometimes bites them till they bleed. The soldier who had just come in was 23 years of age. He was a well-built and rather fine-looking man. splendidly proportioned, with a bronzed skin. His back, uncovered down to the waist, was terribly lacerated, and his body now trembled with fever beneath the damp sheet with which his back was covered. For about an hour and a half, he did nothing but walk up and down the room. I watched his face. He seemed to be thinking of nothing. His eyes had a strange expression, at once wild and timid. They seemed to fix themselves with difficulty on the various objects. I fancied I saw him looking attentively at my hot tea. The steam was rising from the full cup, and the poor devil was shivering and clattering his teeth. I invited him to have some. He turned towards me without saying a word, and, taking up the cup, swallowed the tea at one gulp without adding sugar. He tried not to look at me, and when he had finished, he returned the cup in silence without making a sign, and then began pacing up and down as before. He was in too much pain to think of speaking to me or thanking me. As for the other prisoners, they refrained from questioning him. When once they had applied compresses, they paid no more attention to him, thinking probably that it would be better to leave him alone and not worry him with their questions or their sympathy. The soldier seemed quite satisfied with this arrangement. Meanwhile, it grew dark and the lamp was lighted. Some of the patients possessed candlesticks of their own, but they were not many. In the evening the doctor came round, after which a non-commissioned officer on guard counted the patients and locked the room. The prisoners could not speak too highly of the doctors. They looked upon them as true fathers and held them in great respect. The doctors had always something pleasant to say, a kindly word, even for reprobates, who appreciated it all the more because they knew it was spoken in sincerity. Yes, those kindly words were indeed sincere, for no one would have thought of blaming the doctors had they shown themselves ill-tempered or even quite inhuman. They were gentle purely from compassion. They understood perfectly that a convict who is sick has as much right to breathe pure air as anyone else, even though the latter be a great personage. The convalescents were allowed to walk freely through the corridors for exercise, and to breathe air less pestilential than that of the ward, which was close and saturated with poisonous exhalations. Once the doors had been locked in the evening, they had to remain so throughout the night, and under no pretext was anyone allowed to leave the room. For many years I was unable to understand a certain fact which plagued me like an insoluble problem. I must speak of it before continuing my narrative. I am thinking of the chains which every convict is obliged to wear, however ill he may be. Even consumptives have died beneath my eyes, their legs weighed down with irons. Everyone was accustomed to it and regarded it as an inevitable fact. I do not think the doctors themselves would have thought of demanding the removal of the irons from convicts who were seriously ill, not even from the consumptives. The chains, it is true, were not extraordinarily heavy. They did not, in general, weigh more than 8 or 10 pounds, which is an endurable burden for a man in good health. I have been told, however, that after some years the legs of the convicts dry up and waste away. I do not know whether that is true. I am inclined to think it is. For the weight, however light it may be, say not more than 10 pounds, if it is permanently fixed to the leg, increases the weight of the limb abnormally, and at the end of a certain time must have a disastrous effect on its development. The danger to a healthy convict is not so great, but the same cannot be said of the sick. For those who were seriously ill, for the consumptives, whose arms and legs dry up of themselves, this additional burden is unsupportable. Even if the medical authorities claimed exemption for the consumptive patients only, I am certain that it would prove an immense benefit. I shall be told that convicts are malefactors, unworthy of compassion. But ought we to show increased severity towards those on which the hand of God already weighs? No one will believe that the object of this aggravation is to reform the criminal, and after all, the consumptive prisoners are exempted by the courts from corporal punishment. There must be some mysterious and important reason for the present system, but what it is impossible to understand. No one believes, indeed one cannot believe, that a consumptive man will run away. Who could even imagine such a thing, especially if the disease has reached a certain point? It is impossible to deceive the doctors and lead them to mistake a convict in good health for a consumptive, for this particular malady can be recognized at a glance. Do irons help to prevent a sick convict from escaping? Not in the least. The irons are degrading and shameful, a physical and moral burden, but they will not hinder a man attempting to escape. The most awkward and least intelligent convict can saw through them, or break the rivets by hammering at them with a stone. Chains, then, are a useless precaution, and if they are worn as a punishment, should not that punishment be spared to dying men? As I write these lines, one face stands out in my memory, that of a dying man, a man who died in consumption, the same Mikhailov whose bed was nearly opposite to mine, and who expired, I think, 4 days after my arrival in hospital. When I spoke above of the consumptive patients, I was only reviving involuntary ideas and sensations which occurred to me at the time of this death. I knew Mikhailov very little. He was a young man of 25 at most, not very tall, thin, and with a fine face. He belonged to the special section, and was remarkable for his strange but soft and sad taciturnity. He seemed to have dried up in prison, to use an expression of the convicts who remembered him well. For some strange reason, I recall that he had very fine eyes. He died at 3 o'clock in the afternoon on a clear, dry day. The sun shed its brilliant rays obliquely through the greenish, frozen panes of our room. A torrent of light inundated the happy patient, who had lost consciousness and was several hours dying. Early in the morning, his sight began to fail, and he was unable to recognize those who approached him. The convicts would gladly have done anything to relieve him, for they saw he was in great suffering. His respiration was painful, deep and irregular. His breast rose and fell violently, as though he were in want of air. He cast off his blanket and his clothes. Then he began to tear up his shirt, which seemed to him a terrible burden. It was taken off, and I was horrified to see that immensely long body with fleshless arms and legs, with beating breast and ribs which were as clearly marked as those of a skeleton. There was nothing now on this living corpse but a crucifix and the irons, from which his dried-up legs might easily have freed themselves. A quarter of an hour before he died, all was silent in the ward. The patients spoke only in whispers and walked on tiptoe. From time to time they exchanged remarks on other subjects and cast a furtive glance at the dying man. The rattling in his throat grew more and more painful. At last, with a trembling hand, he felt for the cross on his breast and endeavoured to tear it off. It was too heavy and suffocated him. It was removed. 10 minutes later he died. Someone then knocked on the door in order to warn the sentinel. The warder entered, looking at the dead man with a vacant air, and went away to fetch the assistant surgeon. The latter was quite a good fellow, but a little too preoccupied with his personal appearance. Otherwise, he was most agreeable. He soon arrived, approached the corpse with long strides which re-echoed in the silent ward, and felt the dead man's pulse with an unconcerned air which seemed to have been assumed for the occasion. He then made a vague gesture with his hand and went out. The guardhouse was notified of this death. The man belonged to the special section, and certain formalities had to be carried out in the registration of his death. While we were awaiting the hospital guard, one of the prisoners said in a whisper, "The eyes of the deceased might as well be closed." Another took heed of this remark, and, approaching Mihailov in silence, closed his eyes. Then, noticing the cross which had been taken from his neck lying on the pillow, he took it up and looked at it, put it down, and crossed himself. The face of the dead man was becoming ossified. A ray of white light was playing on the surface and illuminated two rows of fine white teeth, which gleamed between his thin, drawn lips. The sergeant of the guard at last arrived, musket on shoulder and helmet on head, accompanied by two soldiers. He approached the corpse, slackening his pace as if uncertain what he should do next. He looked furtively at the prisoners, but they remained silent and gazed at him with a somber expression. A yard or so from the dead man, he stopped short, as if suddenly nailed to the spot. The naked, dried-up body, loaded with irons, had impressed him. He undid his chin-strap, removed his helmet, which he was not bound to do, and made the sign of the cross. He had a grey head, the head of a soldier who had seen much service. I remembered that by his side stood Chekunov, an old man who was also grey. He kept his eyes upon the sergeant and followed his every movement with strange attention. They glanced across, and I saw that Chekunov also trembled. He clenched his teeth, nodded in the direction of the dead man, murmured almost involuntarily to the sergeant, "He too had a mother." Those words went to my heart. Why had he uttered them, and why had the idea occurred to him? The corpse was raised on its mattress, and the straw creaked. The chains dragged on the floor with a sharp ring. They were taken up, and the body was carried out. Everyone suddenly began to talk again. The sergeant could be heard in the corridor calling to someone to go for the blacksmith who would remove the dead man's irons. But I have digressed from my subject.